All right, so we are very excited to be back with the third episode of Big Screen Book Club. And this is the first one that's actually being recorded in proximity to when it's going to be released. So that's really, really exciting. And we've also got a little bit of a change of pace this episode. The last two episodes we did were based on Nothing Lasts Forever, the basis for Die Hard, and 58 Minutes, the basis for Die Hard 2, both action movies. And this episode, we're going to do things a little differently. We're going to be talking about The Silver Linings Playbook by Matthew Quick, which was adapted into the movie Silver Linings Playbook. And this episode, I am very, very excited to bring on my guest who has never podcasted before, to the best of my knowledge, and that is my brother Keith.
That's me, and you are correct. To the best of my knowledge as well, I have never podcasted.
Well, after today, you can say that you have podcasted, and I know that this will not be the only time you come on the show. I know we've got other books and movies planned to talk about, so this is a voice that you will be hearing more often.
And I hope you enjoy it.
Oh, I'm sure people will. All right, so like I said, we're going to be doing the Silver Linings Playbook by Matthew Quick and the movie Silver Linings Playbook. So are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
Okay, so here we are talking the Silver Linings Playbook by Matthew Quick. And another interesting thing about this book, as opposed to the last two episodes, is it was actually written within the last couple of years. It came out in the fall of 2008, runs 304 pages, and like we said, it is by author Matthew Quick. And now this was his first novel, and prior to that, he was a tenured English teacher in Haddonfield, New Jersey. He wrote the novel while living in Collingswood, and he's lived in Massachusetts. And now lives in the Outer Banks of North Carolina, a place that we've actually vacationed.
We'll have to look them up next time we're there.
Yes. And since the Silver Linings Playbook, he's written six more books, and he's actually ventured into the young adult market. So a little bit of a change of pace, but he's a successful working novelist. And we'll have his thoughts on this adaptation when we get closer to the end of the episode when we talk about the movie. So the Silver Linings Playbook is a book that we both read after seeing the movie, correct?
Yes.
And it's basically about a guy who suffers from a mental illness. A mental illness is not really explicitly described in the book, right?
No, not explicitly described. He just seems like he's had some issues in his personal life, and it kind of led to him being institutionalized for a spell.
Yeah. And he comes out of the institution after, in the book, it's what, 4 or 5 years?
It's been 4 years, yes.
Yeah.
The book, he's been in the institution for 4 years. And even after those 4 years, there's people in his life who feel like he's not ready to come out yet.
Yeah. And he is in the institution kind of directly related to the ending of his marriage, and he's got gaps in his memory where he thinks there's going to be reconciliation. And a lot of the novel really, or the whole plot of the book is really him trying to become a better person for his wife, who he thinks he is just separated from.
Yeah, as far as he remembers, it's just a temporary separation, and he's 100% confident that they will resume their marriage as soon as he has gotten his mental health back in order.
Now let's talk a little bit about the actual prose of this book. This was written in the first person, so the whole book is being narrated by Pat Peoples, and he's a former history teacher who basically, when he gets out of the mental institution, moves back in with his mother and father. Now, what's your take on first person narratives?
I enjoy the first person quite a bit. You really get to see inside the mind of what the main character is thinking and feeling and the motives behind his actions.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think in books, they work really, really, really well. And when we get to the movie, we'll talk about it. But I think one of the biggest obstacles or hurdles that filmmakers have to jump over or figure out when they're adapting a book that has that first person narrative is whether or not they're going to retain it. And most of the time it doesn't work, but then you got movies like Goodfellas where it works extremely well. Now, the book really takes its time setting things up, which is another thing I really, really liked about the book. And the other thing I really, really liked about the book is Pat is really, I think the best way to describe it is he's an unreliable narrator, right?
Oh, totally. I mean, just based on the fact that he's been in the hospital for so long and he has these huge gaps in his memory, it's really hard to take anything he says at face value.
Mm-hmm. Now, another thing I really liked about the book was how well a lot of the other characters were fleshed out. You've got his dad, who's an extremely complex character, his mother, who's very complex. You've got his brother and his best friend. And then you've got the female lead of the book, really, is Tiffany.
Yes.
Now, one thing that I want to talk about, and this will kind of spiral into movie talk, is having read this book after seeing the movie, I got to say that the mental picture I created in my head for a lot of these characters were not the actors who ended up playing them in the movie. Is that something that you were aware of while you were reading the book?
Really? No, that's I think, completely different from my experience. I think if I read a book after I've seen the movie, it's hard for me to not picture those actors as I'm reading the book.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is the movie came out in 2012, and I actually read the book this past fall, so the fall of 2015. So it had been like 3 years since I had seen the movie, because I saw the movie in the theaters. And the only people I really remembered casting-wise was, of course, Pat, Tiffany, and the parents. Mm-hmm. I think everybody else, I forgot who played them. So it was kind of interesting to go back and watch the movie again after reading the book and being like, wow, the mental picture I created there was a lot different.
And I think maybe the distance in time between when I saw the movie and when I read the book was a lot smaller than yours. And that might have changed the experience as well, because I just saw the movie for the first time a few months ago.
Yeah.
I came across it on Netflix and then I read the book very shortly thereafter. So I think the movie was still kind of fresh in my mind.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the other thing I'll say about this book is it seems on the surface like, aside from the narration problem, we consider it a problem for adapting a book into a movie, it seems like it would be a pretty straightforward adaptation. Was that your thought as well?
Yeah, yeah. It seemed like, and I've mentioned this to you before, but as I was reading the book, I could have sworn there was parts in the book that I remembered from the movie, and then it turns out they're not.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of a natural flow, and it seems like it's very natural to adapt it into a film.
Yeah, I sort of had a similar response where, especially having read the book so many years after seeing the movie, that when I did go back and read the movie, I sort of thought I knew the script, and then I was like, oh, wait, this is different than I remembered. So is there anything that you'd like to key in on in the book that you found interesting or that you want to talk about?
Most of my thoughts are going to involve really the big differences between the book and the film. I enjoyed the book a great deal.
Yeah.
I thought it was a really interesting story. I know I've read interviews with the author where he talks a great deal about his experiences with mental illness.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was a really fascinating topic. I thought it was handled very well.
Yeah, I got to agree with you there. I think it was kind of an eye-opening look at mental illness as well, because it sort of showed this, like we talked about, this unreliable narrator who still seems to be having very, very lucid thoughts and tries to explain away discrepancies in his memory.
Yeah, one scene in particular that's in the book that wasn't in the movie that kind of jumped out at me is, like you said, Pat narrates the whole book and he thinks he's perfectly normal and perfectly fine. And he's just, you know, waiting to get back together with his wife. I mean, he knows he's not perfectly fine. He knows there's some issues he has to work out. But as far as he's concerned, he's relatively normal.
Yeah.
And then there's this scene in the book where Pat and Tiffany and his best friend, Ronnie, and Ronnie's wife, Veronica, and their new baby, Emily, go to the beach.
Oh, right.
They spend a day at the beach. And at one point, the girl's getting a little bit of an argument about something. They go off on their own, leaving Pat and Ronnie alone with the baby.
Right.
Ronnie then falls asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Pat picks up the baby, takes the baby out into the ocean, just playing with the baby. He thinks it's perfectly normal, perfectly natural. He's out in the waves playing with the baby, having a good time. Then Veronica comes back, sees Pat alone with the baby, and freaks out.
Yeah.
So Pat thinks he's perfectly normal. Everything's fine. He's just having fun with the baby. Veronica, meanwhile, sees a person who she thinks is, you know, mentally ill, alone with her baby in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And is very disturbed by this.
Yeah. No, that was a scene that I can understand why it wasn't utilized in the movie, but at the same time, it's a shame that it wasn't. I feel there were several moments in the book that were left out of the movie, and you can probably understand why, but you do miss them.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. I just thought that scene was really good for illustrating that, you know, and it's tough in a movie when you've got, you know, a leading man like Bradley Cooper. You kind of have difficulty, you know, picturing him as really mentally, you know, mentally ill.
Yeah.
So, but that scene that takes place in the book really illustrates, no, this guy's not okay.
Yeah. So let's sort of wander over towards the movie. And before we really get into an in-depth discussion about the movie, let's talk about that casting, that Bradley Cooper casting. I think he's a tremendous actor. I mean, he's shown incredible range. You know, we remember him way back from Wedding Crashers,
mm-hmm.
and then all the way up through American Sniper, where he played Chris Kyle, which was a really, really scary performance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't have problems with Bradley Cooper's performance in this movie, but do you think it's a fair assessment to say that the character in the movie is really presented a lot differently than the character in the book?
Oh, sure. No, I agree with that 100%. And it's the same with Tiffany, the Jennifer Lawrence character.
Yeah, I think she was a little bit more in tune, but the one thing I've been thinking about with the character of Pat, I think in the movie, it's what, Salentano?
Yes. Yeah, they changed his name for the movie.
Yeah, which is always interesting. This was one adaptation where I was like, okay, they're not going to change names, and then they did. But the one thing it seemed to me like, I'm not sure if the movie would have played as well if they presented him like they do in the book. Do you have any feelings on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just because in the book he had a lot of issues and a lot of problems. And when you're marketing a film, you at least want your leading man to be at least kind of likable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably the thought process behind that is they wanted to have somebody who would play, you know, as a likable man, that you'd want to spend an entire movie watching this character.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of issues with him in the book that might not have come across as well on screen had they played them as they are in the book.
Yeah, I actually think there were a handful of scenes that really keyed into how disturbed he was. I think one of the scenes where he wakes up his parents in the middle of the night after reading, I think, a Hemingway book.
Mm-hmm.
And then especially the scene where he's looking for the wedding video, which that was a whole aspect in the movie that was really discarded. And I guess it was because in the movie, what, the gap is 8 months?
Yeah, it's only 8 months. Yes. Yeah. 8 months he's been in the hospital in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. So let's move over to the movie, which dropped the and is just Silver Linings Playbook, directed by David O. Russell, based on a screenplay that he wrote, adapting, of course, Matthew Quick's book. Mm-hmm. And David O. Russell is a really, really interesting filmmaker, and he makes really interesting films. A lot of people probably know him from American Hustle,
mm-hmm.
and then also one of my favorite movies, I Heart Huckabees, but he also did Three Kings with George Clooney and Mark Wahlberg, and I think it was Ice Cube. And he's done some other movies too. And I think he's got a movie out right now called Joy, right? With Jennifer Lawrence.
With pretty much the same cast as Silver Linings Playbook. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
He likes those guys.
Mm-hmm. It came out in November of 2012, ran 122 minutes on a budget of $21 million. It grossed $236 million and it got a lot of awards, right? It was nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Film Editing, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Supporting Actor, and Best Supporting Actress. And Jennifer Lawrence actually won for Best Actress.
Yeah, she was the only winner out of the 8 nominations, but still 8 nominations, very impressive. And I actually read that this was the first time since the movie Reds in 1981 that all 4 of the major acting categories, of course, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Supporting Actor, Best Supporting Actress, all came from one film.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. So the father role, Pat Salentano Sr., is played by Robert De Niro. Yep. And the mother, Dolores, is played by Jackie Weaver. Now, we're going to get into detailed discussions of both of them, but I really think that these are two characters that really showcase the huge differences between the book and the movie. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And it was surprising to me because when sitting down and reading this book, you'd think that it would be pretty straightforward adaptation. And, you know, as much as I was shocked at how similar Nothing Lasts Forever was to Die Hard, or Die Hard was to Nothing Lasts Forever, I was equally surprised at the differences between the novel and the movie. So we've also got Shay Whigham as Pat's brother, Jake, who a lot of people probably know from Boardwalk Empire. I'm not sure where else we might have seen him.
Okay, yeah, I didn't recognize him.
Yeah, we have Julia Stiles as Tiffany's sister, Veronica. Mm-hmm. John Ortiz as Ronnie, the Veronica's husband and Pat's friend. And then we've also got, I think that's about it in terms of cast members we're going to talk about. Oh, and also Chris Tucker as Danny McDaniels.
Very different from the book.
Yeah, and we'll get into this discussion, but I actually think that the Danny character in the movie is almost unnecessary.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was, I mean, as compared to his role in the book, concerned that his big scene in the book isn't in the movie,
yeah.
He's completely different. Actually, I shouldn't say, I don't think the character is completely different. I think he's pretty much the same type.
Yeah.
It's just his role is completely different.
He's comic relief.
He is comic relief. I mean, we see him right away, the first scene of the book, when Pat's mother is checking him out of the hospital. Mm-hmm. And he's like, hey, can we give Danny a ride home too? He lives near us.
Yeah.
And then they get a little ways away from the hospital, and the phone rings, and it's the hospital. Danny was not supposed to be out of the hospital at all.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen in the book at all.
Yeah.
And we see Danny pop up like that a few times during the book.
During the movie.
During the movie, where he pops in, and he's not supposed to be there.
Yeah, yeah. And that was something that I really tried to figure out in my head. That's another case where that first-person narration makes it possible to do what they did in the book, where he constantly references things he learned from his friend Danny while he was in the institution. And I don't really think there was any way they could have executed what we saw in the book into the movie. Do you think they could have?
Yeah, no, I think that is one of those things that might be a casualty of the switch from the first person narrative in the book, you know, to the third person in the film. It's tough to pick up because in the book, as I mentioned, Danny doesn't show up till towards the very end.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll touch on that later. But he's still a presence throughout the book because Pat keeps talking about him. And let's not gloss over the fact that I think Pat in the book might be a little racist. Because I know you said he talks about his friend Danny, but no, he doesn't talk about his friend Danny. He talks about his black friend Danny.
Yeah.
Every time Danny's mentioned, it's my black friend Danny. I think that's something that I'm glad they didn't make its way to the movie either.
Yeah. I mean, I was really, really surprised that they even included him in the movie because another major difference is really the endings of these movies are the ending of the book is a lot different than the ending of the movie. Mm-hmm. And Danny's really an integral part of the end of the book, whereas in the movie, there really is no payoff with that character.
No, no. Like you said, he is just comic relief, and I think that's probably why David O. Russell wrote him into the screenplay as such. He just wanted him to be there for some lighter moments.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're definitely right. Another character I want to talk about, and this is where we get into casting, the character of Jake, played by Shay Whigham, and Ronnie, played by John Ortiz. Now, the interesting thing here is I didn't picture Ronnie as John Ortiz, who I really remember from, I think he was the bad guy in Miami Vice. He's popped up a lot. Mm-hmm. In the book, I kind of just really pictured him as, you know, like a middle-aged white guy.
Yeah, I just kind of pictured him as like a preppy kind of middle-aged white guy, you know, wearing cardigan sweaters and, you know, being kind of like, you know, white collar, middle class, you know, just like that.
Yeah, and that character in the movie, they added a lot of angst to that character. And I'm not sure why David O. Russell chose to do it, but in the movie, they really established that Ronnie is frustrated and unhappy in his marriage.
Then when I'm angry, which is a lot these days, I go to the garage. Metallica, Megadeth,
Yeah, which is very different from the book. From the book, he's just very happy. You know, he's got a new baby. He's happy with his life. You know, he's got, you know, he's got the wife, the kid, the white picket fence, the whole American dream type thing.
Yeah.
Movie, not so happy. He's kind of miserable.
Yeah. And that was another change that I didn't really understand. I wasn't sure if they were trying to, you know, contrast different levels of depression.
It very well could be. Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
And moving over to Jake, in the book, he's his younger brother, but did you get that feeling in the movie, or was he even played as the younger brother in the movie?
He felt more like an older brother to me.
Right?
In the film, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And they also made some changes to his character. Now, again, in the book, Pat was in the hospital for 4 years.
Yeah.
In those 4 years, Jake got married.
Yeah.
In the movie, Jake is not married.
No.
He mentions he's engaged, I believe.
Yeah.
He says he's going to be married.
Yeah.
And I don't think we ever see his fiance in the movie at all.
No, Jake was another character who I really felt with the – he was so shortchanged in the movie that he was another character I didn't feel they needed. I mean, there's this – he doesn't pop up in the movie till really late too. It's I think it's close to an hour into the movie.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't really check the time, but it definitely felt like it was pretty late in the film.
Yeah.
It's very integral in the book. He was kind of a really integral part of Pat's support system.
Yeah.
Coming out. I mean, he was in and out of the house the whole time, you know, watching the football games, taking him to the football games. And I think probably in the movie, he's a casualty of the fact that the father becomes a much more major character than he was in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. It's another sort of interesting change. I mean, you have the one major scene with Jake is the one where they sort of reconnect after he got out of that hospital. And, you know, there's this moment where you're not sure how Pat's going to react to seeing his brother. And then he says, "I got nothing but love for you." But there was like in the book that, you know, that kind of has some weight. But in the movie, there was really no weight there for me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. And again, I think it's just because you have Robert De Niro in there as his dad.
Yeah.
He took on much more of that role.
Mm-hmm.
That Jake had in the book.
Yeah, so let's talk about the Robert De Niro character. And from what we've read, a lot of the changes to the Pat Sr. role were based on suggestions from Robert De Niro.
Yeah, I had read an interview that they had stated that De Niro kind of insisted he wanted the father to be much more of a positive figure in the movie. And because De Niro himself, and I don't know the details,
yeah,
but he said he had some experience with mental health issues. I don't know if that was from a family member or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But he kind of wanted to bring that, his personal experience, into the role and take a much more positive role than he had in the book.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And I think the work that De Niro did in this movie was tremendous. Some of his best work in quite a few years. And I think De Niro's rounding another bend where he's coming up on doing really meaningful work after a couple of years of just taking easy money roles.
Wait, you don't think he bought his best at Little Fockers?
Those movies I'll give a pass to, but I'm talking, what, Showtime with Eddie Murphy, Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yeah. Don't give a pass to Little Fockers, though. That was terrible.
Yeah.
The first two had their laughs.
Yes. So the character in the book is really not there.
No, he's absent for much of the book. And Pat's narration, he talks quite a bit about how he's really looking for his dad. He wants to reconnect with his dad. And his dad seems very unwilling. From the beginning, the dad's really not happy that Pat's home.
Yeah, I mean, we've got sequences where he comes home from work, he eats dinner, and then goes into his study and reads Civil War history books.
Yep.
And there's other scenes where he's watching TV and Pat is talking to him and he ignores his son.
Yep, completely ignores him. The only time that Pat Sr. really seems to want Pat around is when the Eagles games are on.
Yeah, for that little bit of luck. And I think what the book was really trying to do was showing that Pat's illness wasn't exclusive to him. And again, it illustrated the different levels of mental illness. And, you know, Pat might have been institutionalized for his illness, but meanwhile, his dad was allowed to continue to exist as a functioning member of society.
Right. And there's this whole running thread through the book where there's real tension on Pat Sr. and his wife's marriage.
Yeah.
To the point where there's a stretch where they're actually, you know, kind of separated.
Yeah.
She basically goes on strike.
Yeah, and that was another thing I really, really missed. I think the Dolores character, and was her name Dolores in the book? I think he just calls her mom in the book.
Yeah, I don't remember a first name.
Yeah. But I think there's so many great moments with the mother in the book that are missing. She really seems like a sketched character in the movie. And I think, again, that's another thing that's hard to pull off, because a lot of the moments in the book that I responded to was Pat realizing how much he was hurting his mother, or mom's crying again, or, you know, just other sequences that involved really the sort of frustration his mother had at wanting her son back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think another thing that was really left out of the movie, and I'm not sure why, was sort of the way the mother was caring for him. She was making sure he took his medicine. She mm-hmm. did clothes shopping for him. She gave him money when he needed to go places. And he references in the book, she gave me $5 to take the train and the bus to the game. Mm-hmm. And then there's a major section later in the book that also occurs in the movie where Pat takes Tiffany on a quote unquote date.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother gives him, what, $40?
She gives him $40, and he gets a bowl of Raisin Bran, and she gets a cup of tea.
Yeah.
And he gives the rest to a waitress as a tip.
Yeah, and in the book, he explains why he orders the Raisin Bran, the rationale. He's worried. He doesn't know what Tiffany's going to order, mm-hmm. So he figures he'll go small. Mm-hmm. And in the movie, it's played completely different.
Why did you order Raisin Bran?
Why did you order tea?
Because you ordered Raisin Bran.
I ordered Raisin Bran because I didn't want there to be any mistaking it for a date.
It can still be a date if you order Raisin Bran.
It's not a date.
And that was another detail I'm surprised that David O. Russell carried over. I think in the movie he says, I ordered Raisin Bran to show this isn't a date. And Tiffany says something the equivalent of, if you're eating Raisin Bran, it can still be a date.
Yep. Yeah. Which I thought was a funny line.
Yeah, it was. It was. But I missed those little details. I really thought those added a lot to the mother character. And again, like you referenced, there's no friction in the marriage, which in the book, it plays a huge part. And for me, it was definitely a missed opportunity, because I thought the mother character in the movie could have been so much more.
Yeah. And again, much like the brother Jake, I think the mom in the movie is just kind of a casualty of the fact that you cast Robert De Niro as the dad.
Yeah.
De Niro's going to get screen time.
Yes.
He's Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
You don't cast Robert De Niro to have him sitting in a study reading history books all day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. So I guess we should at this point talk about the Tiffany Maxwell character played by Jennifer Lawrence. And Jennifer Lawrence is a young actress. She's still in her early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, there was a lot of hesitation about casting her. Because of her age, I think other people that were considered were Elizabeth Banks, Kirsten Dunst, Angelina Jolie, Blake Lively, Rooney Mara, Rachel McAdams, and Olivia Wilde. So you've got a huge collection of actresses there up for the role. And the main problem for me, and I wouldn't call it a problem, it's more just the book really paints her much older. Whereas in the movie, she's a young widow, as opposed to, I think in the book, she's a couple of years older than Pat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't as much of an issue for me. I think, despite her age, I think she carries herself very well. She comes across, I think, a bit older than she actually is.
Yeah.
Plus, she's got kind of that smoky voice.
Yeah. Her character in the movie, I think, was one of the most well-painted. And I think if any character in the movie really benefited from a performance, I think it was hers. I think Jennifer Lawrence did a tremendous job really showing a girl who had problems and was aware of them, but was still dealing with them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And her performance, obviously she won the Oscar for, so yeah. It worked.
Yeah. Very, very good point. Now, as we're talking here, I'm remembering all these differences in the book and the movie, and I don't want to get off track here, but another huge difference here, and we're going to jump a little bit further into the movie, which is really, I think, the ending point of the movie, but more like three quarters in the book, and that's the dance competition.
Yeah, I actually, well, I took a lot of notes while I was reading the book, because I knew we were going to be doing this, and I made a note of it somewhere, and I think you're right, it was three quarters, and I made a note of myself. I'm like, this is way too early for this.
Yeah.
I think it's 76%.
Yeah.
So I was reading on my Kindle, 76%.
Yes. So in the movie, that really, it really shapes, it's the climax of the film. And there's a huge difference there in the sense that in the movie, it's played as a serious competition where you're scored and you're judged.
Mm-hmm. They were up against professional dancers.
Professional dancers. Whereas in the book, and I can totally understand why they didn't do this, it was basically a dance recital for mainly disturbed teens, right?
Yeah, I think it was called Dance Away Depression.
Yeah. And they were dancing against teenage girls, and there was no awards, there were no trophies, and there was no scoring. I thought in the book that was a great payoff because, you know, you've got her sort of, you know, leading Pat on, convincing him that he has to do this dance competition with her, and, you know, says they have to take first place.
Oh, yeah. She doesn't – at no point does she tell Pat that it's just a recital.
Yeah.
She makes him think this is a – she makes it think like it is in the movie.
Yeah.
She treats it like this is a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. And so that was a big difference. And it's interesting that David O. Russell was sort of able to use the dance as sort of his ending because the book goes into really different territory after that.
Yeah, well, the book still got 25% to go after that.
Yeah, I mean, we get the reveal that Tiffany was lying to Pat about letters that he was exchanging with his wife.
Yep, that's a whole thread in the book, and there's actually a lot, that's a bit different too. Just to backtrack,
yeah,
with the letters, just you know, to explain it for people who may not have remembered or maybe haven't seen the movie yet. And if you haven't seen the movie, by the way, spoiler alert. In the book, there is a series of letters exchanged back and forth between Pat and what he thinks is his estranged wife.
Yeah.
Whose name is Nikki, by the way. I don't think we mentioned that.
No.
And we know that actually, no, I don't think they reveal it till later, but you can kind of put the pieces together. And it's actually Tiffany writing those letters.
Yeah.
As Nikki. There's a whole string of letters back and forth. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I think there's 8 letters. The movie is really just one.
Yeah, and they're printed verbatim in the book, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Now, the other thing about the letters is, in the book, there's sort of an explanation for how Tiffany knows the details that she knows, and it's the fact that she sort of befriends the mother character during Pat's parents' separation.
Mm-hmm.
So another big difference with the letters and the payoff is, in the book, it's really a means to show that Tiffany was lying and to ultimately have Pat forgive her. Whereas in the movie, we get sort of a payoff where Nikki shows up at the dance recital.
Yeah. And that brings us back to the dance recital again, because there was more I wanted to say about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the book, we never meet Nikki.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of tangentially we do. In the book, the only time Pat actually sees Nikki is his brother drives him out to where she lives.
Yeah.
And kind of from down the block, he sees that, you know, she's
remarried.
I think she's outside playing in the snow with her new husband, and she has a kid.
Uh-huh.
And which I guess would be trickier to pull off in the film, because in the film it's only been 8 months.
Yeah.
But it's been 4 years again in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Pat kind of sees from afar that she's happy and she has this a new life, and that gives him the closure that he needs.
Yeah.
Just to know that she's happy.
Yeah.
Not at all what happens in the movie.
No, in the movie we do get a moment between the two of them, but a lot of that we don't get to hear. He whispers in her ear, right?
Yes. I think the implication is that, you know, hey, you know, nice to see you. Thanks for coming. But there's somebody else in my life now.
Yeah.
I've moved on.
Yeah. So while we're talking about the wife character, the Nikki character, another thing that is drastically different between the book and the movie is how they present the incident that led to Pat being institutionalized.
Yes.
And in the book, he sort of spends the whole book regaining his memories of what led to it. Whereas in the movie, they almost lead with it.
Yeah. In the movie, he knows pretty early on what happened. And for those who are listening who don't know, and who don't want, you don't care about spoilers if you haven't seen it or read it. Pat's wife was cheating on him.
Yeah.
I think in the book they explained it's somebody else that works with them, right? They both worked at the same school.
Yeah, it was another one. It was another teacher.
Yeah. And Pat comes home and catches them together in the shower.
Mm-hmm.
And there's kind of a violent encounter.
Yeah.
It's kind of explicitly gone into detail in the book, you know, about how he's beating this guy. But in the movie, this is shown as kind of a flashback very early on in the film.
Yeah, there's no mystery as to what happened. Whereas I think in the book, it's really effective that you're sort of going along for the journey with Pat as he uncovers what happened. And another missing element that I really think they could have pulled off was in the book, the song that is playing when he catches his wife is a Kenny G song.
Yes.
And in the movie, it's, I think, My Sharia Moore by Stevie Wonder. And I can't remember what Kenny G song it is.
I believe it was Songbird.
Songbird, yes. And there's a lot of moments in the book where he has visions of Kenny G playing the song right in his face.
Yeah, yeah.
And those are trigger moments for him. And yes, he calms himself by basically doing a meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I really think that this could have worked in the movie.
you just think they couldn't have gotten Kenny G maybe?
I'd like to think that Kenny G has enough of a sense of humor about himself to do that. And I mean, at no point is Kenny G painted in a bad light, aside from the fact that it's his music that sort of is so linked to Pat's worst moments.
Right, right. I believe it's also not just that that song was playing when he caught them in the shower, like they had the radio on in the bathroom. That was also their wedding song.
Right. Okay. Yeah, which makes it even more of a sort of knife being twisted moment.
Right. The knife was already firmly in the back, and that was just a big twist on it.
Yeah. So moving along, I think another character who plays a fairly decent role in the movie, but is nowhere near as sketched out as he is in the book, is his therapist and friend, mm-hmm. Dr. Cliff Patel.
Cliff Patel, yes.
And there are lots of moments in the book where we spend a lot of time on the couch with the two of them.
Yeah, yeah. He spends there's too many to count how many times he's in the doctor's office in the book. And again, I guess, you know, when you're adapting a close to 400-page novel for a two-hour movie, you can't have him in the doctor's office 23 times.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was certainly a much more fleshed-out character.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing that I found is the introduction of the Eagles fans that mm-hmm. that tailgated the Eagles games, the Asian Invasion, which yes. is a bus full of Indian guys.
Yes.
And in the book, there's a reason that they show up. Whereas, again, in the movie, there's really no reason for Dr. Cliff to show up at the Eagles game when they're tailgating.
No, no, not at all. In the book, that really helps them bond.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it really helps Pat open up to him, you know, trust him a lot. You don't really get a sense of that in the film. It's just like, hey, look, my doctor's at the Eagles game.
Yeah, that was another character that I think, unfortunately, you know, sort of fell by the wayside. And I really like the detail in the book where he's got, what, the brown chair and the black chair.
Yes.
And he lets you choose which one. And that sort of gives him a handle on where your mind is that day.
Right. And Pat figures this out. Pat knows this.
Mm-hmm.
And Pat makes a point of telling us every time he goes to the doctor which chair he picks based on his mood.
Yeah, yeah.
To go back briefly to the Asian invasion at the football game,
mm-hmm.
There is one reason it plays out a little bit differently in the movie than it did in the book.
Yeah.
In the movie, the Asian invasion shows up, and there's a bunch of other fellow drunk Eagles fans, you know, tailgating before the game, who are kind of getting a little bit racist at the Indian guys. And that causes, you know, a little bit of a brawl, and Pat intervenes and throws a punch at somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of a big deal for somebody with his mental health.
Yeah.
He needs to kind of keep calm. And I think that's why we see the Asian invasion show up at the games in the movie, not to kind of solidify the bond between the doctor and Pat, but to have that fight break out.
Which
in the book happens for a completely different reason, not relating to the Asian invasion. It was actually just the Eagles were playing the Giants that day, this guy was a drunk Giants fan.
Yeah, and he showed up in the Eagles game with his kid in Giants gear.
In Giants gear and starts harassing the Eagles fans and then kind of has it coming.
Yeah, yeah. And which forces them to move to another part of the stadium the following game, yes. The following home game, so they don't run into that guy, because in the book, Pat really...
Oh, Pat thinks he's going back to the hospital. He thinks he's done for.
Yeah.
He thinks he really screwed up. They're going to find him. The police are going to find him. He's going to go get sent back to the hospital because he punched this guy.
Yeah. So another aspect of the Eagles that I want to key on here is it seemed like in the book we're a lot more aware of how the Eagles are doing and how their season is progressing. Whereas in the movie, it's really sort of high level.
Yeah, yeah. It's much more of a backdrop.
Yeah. Another interesting thing, and we were sort of talking about the differences with the Pat Sr. character, is in the book, he's recently unemployed and he's opened up, a bookmaking business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's another huge difference between the dad in the book and the dad in the movie. And
which also leads to another character in the movie.
Yeah.
Who's this kind of guy, I don't know.
Randy.
He's kind of making bets with Pat Sr.
Yeah.
Which brings us back to the dance competition, where there's this whole ridiculous bet.
Yeah.
What their score is going to be in the dance competition.
Yeah, I'm glad you said it was ridiculous, because I really felt that this was the most Hollywood aspect of the movie, where you have them, you know, I guess Pat Sr.'s just lost a huge bet to Randy, and they're going to go double or nothing on the Giants game, right?
I think it was the Giants.
Yeah.
Either way, it's the Eagles.
Yeah. They're going to go double or nothing on the game, but then they tie it into the dance competition.
It's a parlay.
Yeah. We learn what a parlay is.
Will somebody please explain me the parlay, please?
You got to win two bets or you lose the whole thing. For Pat Sr. to win, the Birds got to beat the Cowboys. Plus, Pat and Tiffany got to get at least a 5 at the dance.
That's very, very manic indeed.
And for me, that really felt like the most Hollywood moment in a movie that really isn't that Hollywood.
No, it's true. And it kind of seems to come out of left field, too.
Yeah.
Where they're going double or nothing in the game, and then Randy's like, well, wait a minute, what about this dance thing?
Yeah, I think it was really, for whatever reason, a way to add additional weight to the dance competition, whereas in the book, it's really just the fact that they do it.
Right, right. And again, I did, you know, 3/4 way through the book, this dance recital happens. But when they change it to a dance competition in the film and kind of move it to the end, like you said, it does lend it more weight and more importance. It was kind of a genuinely funny moment, despite the fact that this whole parlay bet thing seemed kind of silly. When they get their scores, because the score they needed to get was a 5.0.
Yes.
They needed to get a 5.0 or better for Pat Sr. to win the bet.
Mm-hmm.
And when the scores were revealed, they get exactly 5.0. And everybody at the competition is, oh my God, we're so sorry that, you know, you deserve better than that. Meanwhile, they're ecstatic.
Yeah.
They're overjoyed that they hit this 5.0.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was kind of a funny moment. Everybody else is just like, why are they so excited about a 5.0?
Yeah. Now, with the ending of the movie where we have basically they win the big bet. Pat Sr. gets all his money back.
I'm sorry to interject. Yeah. Also, that's another huge difference. Pat Sr.'s at the dance in the movie.
Yeah, okay.
He doesn't show up in the book.
No.
He's not coming to some goofy dance recital.
Yeah, very good point. So the movie basically ends with Pat having that moment of closure with his ex-wife.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically running after Tiffany, who has left the dance in tears.
Yeah, because she saw Pat kind of go over to Nikki to have a moment with her.
Yeah.
By this point, they've fallen in love.
Yeah.
Pat and Tiffany are completely in love with each other. They just haven't admitted it to each other yet.
Yeah.
She sees Pat go over to his ex-wife, and she kind of freaks out and runs out.
Yeah. And then Pat also explains to her that he knows that she wrote the letters and that he loves her. Mm-hmm. Now, in a vacuum, I think that's a really, really, really good ending.
Right.
I mean, it's a Hollywood ending, but I think it's the ending that everybody wants.
Sure, sure.
Now, let's contrast that with the ending of the book, where there's a huge fallout from learning that Tiffany wrote the letters.
Right. Those letters are a huge sticking point. And that's even one of the things where, while I was reading the book, and, you know, you kind of get revealed that Tiffany's been writing these letters all along, and she's kind of doing it to string Pat along a little bit.
Yeah.
That was the point in the book where I was just like, Tiffany's really a nice person. And I know she's supposed to be, she's supposed to also be suffering from some unidentified form of mental illness.
Yeah.
But which didn't make her a very sympathetic character to me. I was just like, this just seems kind of mean.
Yeah.
Whereas you don't get that in the movie because, number one, it's Jennifer Lawrence doing it.
Yeah.
And number two, Pat forgives her so quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, not even forgives her. He's not even upset by it.
Yeah, he admits that he knows it was her and it's all cool. Whereas in the book, it really plays out where Pat's brother, Jake, says if he ever sees her again, he'll kill her.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no. Jake wants to murder Tiffany.
Yeah, yeah.
He straight up is going to murder her.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, it paints her in a very unsympathetic light because it just comes across as so mean. And Pat, I think, is rightfully upset. Because this entire time, and again, it plays much differently in the book than it did in the movie. He is still, until the very end of the book, working very hard to try and get his ex-wife back.
Yeah, yeah. So as effective as the ending was, or as satisfying as the ending of the movie was, for me, the ending of the book is so well done. You've basically got Pat sending a final letter to his ex-wife, who has said she's not going to see him, saying, meet me at dusk on, is it Christmas Eve or is it Christmas?
I think it's Christmas Eve.
Yeah. Meet me at dusk where I propose to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I can finally say what I need to say to you to get closure. And he proceeds to get his ass kicked.
Yeah, yeah. He goes to what he thinks is a meeting with his wife. She's not there, of course. But this is Tiff actually shows up, correct?
Yes.
And this is where she reveals to him that she's the one that wrote the letters.
Yeah.
That's how in the movie, he figures it out on his own.
Yeah.
In the book, she shows up to this supposed meeting with his wife and says, no, sorry, she's not coming. It's me. It's been me this whole time writing letters. They have a huge fight. Pat runs off, kind of gets into a sketchy neighborhood and gets mugged.
Yeah.
He gets his ass beat down.
Yeah.
And this is actually where his black friend Danny shows up.
Exactly. And it almost becomes like a Christmas miracle.
Yeah. And this is the one part of the book that I kind of had a little issue with. Not a huge issue, but he gets mugged in the street. Nobody's there to help him.
Yeah.
And then he kind of wakes up on his own. I'm not sure how much time had passed, but he kind of comes to and realizes he's just been mugged and beaten. He just goes to the first house he sees, and it's his friend Danny.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a Christmas miracle. Fine. Seemed a bit coincidental to me.
Yeah. Yeah. But it felt like one of those moments where it's like, life gets incredibly crazy at times and you couldn't write some of the things that happen. And at least for the way that character was sort of painted throughout the whole book, that reveal was really good.
Yeah, yeah.
So then we get several weeks of Pat recovering from his injuries.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we get he gets a letter from Tiffany and then he goes to meet her. And that's where we get the explanation about Jake driving him out to see his wife and observing her from afar and realizing she's happy and really getting the closure that he needs. In the book, he's sort of pretending that his whole life is a movie and movies have happy endings.
Right.
And then we get this really great scene, I think, where Tiffany gives him a belated birthday present, which is a book that sort of what shows you how to chart clouds.
Yeah, yeah. It's a cloud chart.
Mm-hmm. And they lay on the ground together and they watch clouds. Mm-hmm. And he pulls Tiffany close to him and she says that she needs him. And he basically kisses her and says, I think I need you too. And then that's the end of the book.
Yep. And those are two – it's funny how just swapping out one four-letter word, one simple four-letter word for another four-letter word kind of changes the tone of the entire thing.
Okay.
Because the book ends with them saying to each other, I need you.
Mm-hmm.
The movie ends with them both saying, I love you.
Right, right.
Very, very different.
Yeah, yeah. So before we get into our closing thoughts here, let's talk a little bit about Matthew Quick's feelings on the movie and where he was when the movie came out. He did an interview with Forbes where they asked him, how did he find out that the book had been optioned to become a movie? And he says, I quit my job and lived with my in-laws for 3 years. When I sold Silver Linings, I was literally down to my last dollar. I got an agent and that was mind-blowing because when I quit my job, everyone made me feel like I was making a huge mistake. But I felt like I was going to make art or die. It wasn't an option. When I got the agent, that was great. It felt like I was on my way. He says he got a call in Vermont and he didn't recognize the area code. And that's when he found out that his book had been optioned by Sidney Pollack and Anthony Minghella, who both passed away before the movie was able to be developed. So eventually, David O. Russell started developing it. And on the changes between the movie and the book, he said, "I think one of the things that's given me an edge over other people and some of my other writing friends is that I've always been able to separate the art from the business. When you're writing alone in a room, you're an artist, but when you send it to New York or LA, you have to be a professional because you're selling it," which I think is a really good perspective. And I know other authors have had that sort of take on things too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He says, "I know that when I send my work, I'm selling a product. That's not to demean my art. I love the book. I stand by it. And I'm very proud of it. But when you're making a living, you have to make partnerships with people." He says, "When I heard David O. Russell was involved, I was thrilled because I love his work. I was thrilled he would take on my book. It's the first adaptation that he's ever done. I thought I could learn from this. I love movies. I watch tons of movies, and it's a different medium than a book. Things that work in a book won't work in a movie. I took it as a learning experience to gain knowledge, but it was a little tough. He didn't include me at all in the writing process. I didn't meet him until I was on the movie set, but we got friendly when we started to promote the movie. I felt like he was really nervous that I wouldn't like what he did. After I saw the movie, he called me and we talked for an hour. I get it. When I write, I don't want anyone looking over my shoulder. He had to make the movie his. A lot of the changes he had to make for mercenary reasons. Why change the father role? Well, Robert De Niro has experience with mental illness and he wanted the role to be more positive, which is what we talk about. He says he wasn't looking at Jennifer Lawrence, but she Skyped an audition and they were blown away and rewrote the part for her." So very interesting to see Matthew Quick's very positive response to his work being adapted, whereas you have other authors like Alan Moore who really despise the thought of their work being adapted.
Yeah, yeah. Alan Moore has a very kind of negative attitude on that, and that's one way to do it, and Matthew Quick took the other road, which is fine.
Yeah, I think it was Stephen King or Elmore Leonard, I can't remember who somebody came to his house one day, one of his friends, and said, "Aren't you angry that they ruined your book?" And he pointed to his bookshelf and he said, "My book's right there."
Yep, yep, exactly.
Which I think is a great perspective. And I got to say that I enjoy the book, The Silver Linings Playbook, and I enjoy the movie. Is that your experience?
Oh, absolutely. I enjoyed them both a great deal. In fact, when I saw the movie for the first time, I was kind of blown away a little bit because I guess I wasn't sure what to expect.
Yeah.
I think my experience with the movie was I just kind of was, you know, scrolling through Netflix one day and saw it was on there. And I was like, yeah, you know, this was, you know, got great reviews. You know, won a bunch of awards. I'll check it out. And yeah. I think the reason I had been avoiding it for so long, I kind of had the wrong-headed impression that it was, quote-unquote, a chick flick.
Sure.
Turns out it's not.
Yeah.
Not at all. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I even went on Facebook and posted to everybody. I was like, hey, if you haven't seen this movie, check it out because it's really fantastic. And despite the kind of the Hollywood ending, and like you said before, you know, in a vacuum, the Hollywood ending is great.
Yeah.
It works fine. Despite some of the hokey things, the biggest problem, I think, being the parlay, turning the betting on the dance.
Yeah.
I think it's a fantastic film, great performances all around. Then I read the book afterwards, and I thought the book was fantastic.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, taken individually, they're both really, really great works.
Yeah. Now, the more important question here is, do you think the movie was a worthy adaptation of the book?
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely. I think so. Despite all the differences we've talked about, I think we hit on pretty much everything that I wanted to talk about. As far as the differences go between the two.
Yeah.
I still think it does a great job of kind of, you know, shedding some light on what it's like for people living with a mental illness. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I would agree. I would say this is a worthy adaptation because ultimately the message that the book and the movie deliver is the same. They get to the same place.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So very cool. And unless you have anything else you want to say about either the book or the movie, I think we might be done here.
Yeah, no, I was looking over my notes and I kind of had a list of all the things I wanted to touch on that were different between the two. And I think we hit them all.
All right. Very cool. Well, this was a great discussion. I enjoyed it so much, and I look forward to speaking with you again for we have a couple of different books and movies that we've talked about.
Sure. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. And looking ahead to next month, we'll be talking about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with returning guest BJ Cramp. So be on the lookout for that. Also, if you're on Twitter and you want to follow the show, you can follow us at Book Club Pod. And if you're on Facebook, you can search Big Screen Book Club and join our group. And Keith, do you want to give out any of your social media handles?
I am on the Twitter. You can find me on Twitter at Strutter71. I don't tweet that often, but if people are listening to this and want to, you know, start a conversation, I'll start tweeting more.
Very good. So thank you again for coming on and talking the Silver Linings Playbook with me.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
All right. And we will talk to you next time on Big Screen Book Club.